Numbers chapter 11. Numbers chapter 11. God had just brought his people away from the place where they've been comfortable for nearly a year. They'd parked, they'd camped at Mount Sinai, and they've been comfortable there. Now, last week we left Mount Sinai. We've gone off into the desert. And as they begin this wandering in the desert, they're beginning to take some steps forward. In fact, in the text, the two chapters here this morning, we're going to see that they take three steps forward. But while moving forward, they take four steps backward. That's the way it is oftentimes in the wilderness, isn't it? Numbers chapter 11. We'll read the whole thing. We'll read chapter 12 as well. So buckle your pew belts and hang on for the ride this morning. Numbers 11, verse 1. And the people complained in the hearing of the Lord about their misfortunes, about the evil. And when the Lord heard it, his anger was kindled, and the fire of the Lord burned among them and consumed some outlying parts of the camp. Then the people cried out to Moses, and Moses prayed to the Lord, and the fire came down. The fire died down. So the name of that place was called Taberah, because the fire of the Lord burned among them. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel also wept again and said, "Oh, that we had meat to eat. We remember the fish that we ate in Egypt that cost nothing, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. But now our strength is dried up, and there's nothing at all but this manna to look at." Now the manna was like coriander seed, its appearance like that of delium. The people went about and gathered it and ground it in handmills, or beat it in mortars and boiled it in pots and made cakes of it. And the taste of it was like the taste of cakes baked with oil. When the dew fell upon the camp in the night, the manna fell with it. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans, everyone at the door of his tent, and the anger of the Lord blazed hotly. And Moses was displeased. Moses said to the Lord, "Why have you dealt ill with your servant? Why have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people on me? Did I conceive all this people? Did I give them birth that you should say to me, 'Carry them in your bosom as a nurse carries a nursing child to the land that you swore to give to their fathers'? Where am I going to get meat to give to all this people? For they weep before me and say, 'Give us meat that we may eat.' I am not able to carry all this people alone. The burden is too heavy for me. If you will treat me like this, kill me at once if I find favor in your sight, that I may not see my wretchedness." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Gather for me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom you know to be the elders of the people, and officers over them, and bring them to the tent of meeting, and let them take their stand with you there. And I will come down and talk with you there. I will take some of the spirit that is on you and put it on them, and they shall bear the burden of the people with you, so that you may not bear it yourself alone. And say to the people, 'Consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, and you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, "Who will give us meat to eat? For it was better for us in Egypt." Therefore the Lord will give you meat to eat, and you shall eat. You shall not eat just one day, or 2 days, or 5 days, or 10 days, or 20 days, but a whole month, until it comes out at your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you, because you have rejected the Lord who is among you, and have wept before him, saying, "Why did we come out of Egypt?" But Moses said, "The people among whom I am number 600,000 on foot. And you've said, 'I'll give them meat that they may eat a whole month.' Shall flocks and herds be slaughtered for them and be enough for them? Shall all the fish of the sea be gathered together for them and be enough for them?" And the Lord said to Moses, "Is the Lord's hand shortened? Now you shall see whether my word will come true for you or not." So Moses went out and told the people the words of the Lord. And he gathered 70 of the elders of the people and placed them around the tent. Then the Lord came down in the cloud and spoke to him, took some of the spirit that was on him and put it on the 70 elders. And as soon as the spirit rested on them, they prophesied, but they did not continue doing it. Now two men remained in the camp, one named Eldad, the other named Medad, and the spirit rested on them. They were among those registered, but they had not gone out to the tent, and so they prophesied in the camp. And a young man ran and told Moses, "Eldad and Medad are prophesying in the camp." And Joshua, the son of Nun, the assistant of Moses from his youth, said, "My lord Moses, stop them." But Moses said to him, "Are you jealous for my sake? Would that all the Lord's people were prophets, that the Lord would put his spirit on them." And Moses and the elders of Israel returned to the camp. Then a wind from the Lord sprang up, and it brought quail from the sea, and let them fall beside the camp about a day's journey on this side, and a day's journey on the other side around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the ground. And the people rose all that day and all night and all the next day and gathered the quail. Those who gathered least gathered 10 omers. That means nothing to us. It's about 8 55-gallon drums worth of meat. 10 homers. And they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. Verse 33. While the meat was yet between their teeth, before it was consumed, the anger of the Lord was kindled against the people. And the Lord struck down the people with a very great plague. Therefore the name of that place was called Kibroth Hattaavah, because there they buried the people who had the craving. From Kibroth Hattaavah, the people journeyed to Hazeroth, and they remained at Hazeroth. Now, Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman whom he had married. For he had married a Cushite woman. And they said, "Has the Lord indeed spoken only through Moses? Has he not spoken through us also?" And the Lord heard it. Now the man Moses was very meek, more than all people who were on the face of the earth. And suddenly the Lord said to Moses and to Aaron and to Miriam, "Come out, you three, to the tent of meeting." And the three of them came out. And the Lord came down in a pillar of cloud and stood at the entrance of the tent and called Aaron and Miriam. And they both came forward, and he said, "Hear my words. If there is a prophet among you, I, the Lord, make myself known to him in a vision. I speak with him in a dream. Not so with my servant Moses. He is faithful in all my house. With him I speak mouth to mouth, clearly and not in riddles. And he beholds the form of the Lord. Why then were you not afraid to speak against my servant Moses?" And the anger of the Lord was kindled against them, and he departed. When the cloud removed from over the tent, behold, Miriam was leprous like snow. And Aaron turned toward Miriam, and behold, she was leprous. And Aaron said to Moses, "Oh, my Lord, do not punish us because we've done foolishly and have sinned. Let her not be as one dead, whose flesh is half eaten away when he comes out of his mother's womb." And Moses cried to the Lord, "Oh, God, please heal her, please." But the Lord said to Moses, "If her father had but spit in her face, should she not be shamed for 7 days? Let her be shut outside the camp for 7 days, and after that she may be brought in again." So Miriam was shut outside the camp for 7 days. The people did not set out on the march till Miriam was brought in again. After that, the people set out from Hazeroth and camped in the wilderness of Paran. We come to this passage. We're going to see that the children of Israel, they've left Mount Sinai, and they're on the march. They're moving north. They'd crossed the Red Sea. They're in the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula, and they're beginning their trek north. But they're moving, because there's no other way to move, they're moving through the desert. So the illustrators here set up some buzzards and a dead skull there. They're just illustrating the fact that they're not in a garden place, per se. They're still in the wilderness. They're still in the desert. As they march through the desert, they start being concerned with things that you and I might be concerned with. One writer said, you know, as we read through these complaints of the children of Israel out in the desert, we have a tendency to commiserate with their miseries. He said, that's not the way God presents it. God sees their failures at this point as something that reveals a lack of faith. But they're hungry. And they're hungry for something other than the manna. And they start remembering different things as you're out in the middle of a dry desert. They're talking about things like melons, things that are juicy, things that are sweet as they're out in the middle of the wilderness. And then chapter 12, we come to this scene where the leadership, a leadership package, if you will, is infighting at the head of the journey here. And so we're not very long into our journey, and we see that we're moving from three different places. And in these three moves, there's four serious setbacks along the way. You know, as we travel through the wilderness, we're going to take wrong turns. We're going to take wrong turns, but the goal this morning is to remind us that as we're traveling through the desert, we're going to get lost if we do it alone. The whole point of this book of Numbers is learning to walk by faith. And faith is living life now in light of the living God. If I walk through this desert, if I travel through the wilderness, wandering through the wilderness on my own, I'm left to wander. I'm left to do it by myself unless I do it with God. Now, for the first 10 chapters of the book of Numbers, the children of Israel have been doing a good job. They've been doing what God says. They're setting themselves up. They're ordering themselves under. They're ordering themselves around. They're designing their life to rotate and revolve with God at the center of it. But as soon as they get out, in fact, go back to chapter 10, verse 33. So they set out from the mount of the Lord, how many days' journey? 3 days' journey. Chapter 11 starts, we're 3 days away from Sinai. If we were to go back to Exodus, chapter 15, we'll see that it only took 3 days away from the Red Sea. And we have the same scenario painted out for us. 3 days into the journey, and already in their forward progress, they're suffering some severe setbacks. What I want us to look at today is four faith failures. Failures in walking with God by faith, not by sight. Failures in doing life with God, rather doing life on my own in the wilderness. And these faith failures are going to hinder the progress, the forward motion, the forward momentum of the people of God. Even though they're still the people of God, He's designed them to bring them to the promised land, and He's doing that. He will do that. But they make it more difficult than need be. We make it more difficult than need be because we walk by sight rather than faith. Now, the book of Corinthians, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, reminds us that these things happen to them for an example to you. You're the ones who are on a wilderness journey. You're the ones who are on a journey between there, that place of bondage, Egypt, sin, slavery, and there, that place of promise, blessing, the land flowing with milk and honey. It's you who are on a journey. It's you who are wandering in the wilderness. It's you that God is tabernacling with. It's you that God is with by the power of His Spirit, that He's leading His dear children along. It's you. So listen this morning, not just condemning Israel for their dumbness in their faith failures, because they is we. We make these same failures, and we hinder our own progress in this walk of faith in these specific ways in the wilderness. The first is this. There's complaining about God's providence. We start up in chapter 11 with the first three verses. It's kind of a paradigmatic account. It's very simple. It's very basic. We find out that the people sin. We find out that because of their sin, God's anger is provoked. We find out that when God's anger is provoked, divine judgment is sent. When God sends His judgment, we see that the people turn to Moses, who intercedes on behalf of the people. And when Moses intercedes, that divine judgment is removed. That's kind of the pattern. And as things move forward from this pattern, we're going to see ways in which other instances meet the pattern or don't meet the pattern. But this is the pattern. Sin, failure, God's anger is provoked. God sends a judgment. Moses intercedes, and God removes the judgment, and they move on. We see in these verses, verse 1, the people sin. The people sinned because the people complained. In context, again, this is only 3 days out. Wiersbe reminds us that so sinful is the human heart that it's prone to forget God's blessing, ignore God's promises, and find fault with God's providence. They're complaining. You know what complaining sounds like? Have you heard complaining? I looked up what this word means in my great Hebrew and Aramaic lexicon. Hang on. Here's what complaining sounds like. It says, cow, to moo lugubriously. Say, what in the world does that mean? Let me show you. What does complaining sound like? Cow, to moo lugubriously. I don't sound like that. You sound like that. When you complain, you know what you sound like? That's why mom rolls her eyes and looks at dad when the child goes, right? That's what's going on. Now, this is a verb, and it's in a certain tense. It's in the hithpale tense. You should all go, ooh, okay? Yeah, that doesn't mean a lot. Here's what it means. It means that the person who does this thing is actually transforming themselves to become this thing. So, when you moo like a lugubrious cow, which is a very complaining cow, it says you become cow-like. It doesn't just say that they complained. It says they became complainers. And the idea is they started to complain and they started to become characterized by their complaining. It wasn't just that they did it and they were done. They became what they did. You ever told your kid, don't do that, your face is going to get stuck like that? You didn't tell them that because it's not usually that cold. In Minnesota, we tell them that because it gets cold and then it gets frozen in that way. But in a real sense, he says, when you do this, you become like this. The people became complainers of evil in the ears of the Lord. They complained about their misfortunes, and literally the word there is they complained about their evil. Up in chapter 10, verse 29, Moses was excited. He's talked to Hobab, and he says, hey, Hobab, you got to come with us because God has promised good to Israel. They're 3 days out. They know good is coming. They're excited about the good, but all they can see is the bad, the bad. You ever had somebody who's like a drama queen? It's like, oh, I can't believe it. That's where they're at. Do we have any eighth grade girls in here? No, good. Okay, they're like an eighth grade girl. Oh, I can't believe it. Life is so miserable. Life is so horrible. They're complaining about how tough life is. You never do that, do you? But somebody you know does. And somebody who knows you knows somebody who does. That's the whole point. They're complaining. They're complaining about the evils, and we're not told what these evils might have been. We can imagine. They're in the desert. What's in the desert? Hot during the day. What's in the desert at night? Cold. Do you like it when you're too hot? Do you like it when you're too cold? What do you do when you're too hot or too cold? All right? You complain. You moo lugubriously. You go to the thermostat. Who moved the thermostat? Life is so bad because I don't feel good. It's too hot. It's too cold. There's little water in the desert. All they have to look at is something that is brown. This summer we had Colleen's brother up from Texas and his wife. And they pulled into our place and they stood on the back deck and they said, wow. I said, what? They said, green. Everything's brown down in Texas. We're just not used to this, like, green. Every day you get up, brown, 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 brown rocks, brown bushes, brown sand, brown birds, brown manna, brown everything. And what'd they do? Complained about it. They're living a nomadic life. There's no routine. They're getting up when the sun comes up. They're going to bed when the sun goes down. And then they're moving whenever this cloud of God decides to move. That means everything they own has to be moved from one place to another. Surely is moving from one place to another. How's it going to get there? Before U-Hauls. How's it going to get there? Before paved roads. How's it going to get there? Well, you're going to move it. Or you're going to hook it up to something that can move it. And as it's going along the road, it's going to get stuck. It's going to be difficult. It's going to be heavy. There's going to be limited communication. You're in this long line of maybe 2 million people, and you're stuck right in the middle of it. And you're going who knows where but God, literally. So God is out in front of you, and you're stuck in this line, and it's like rush hour. The guy in front of you going too slow. The guy behind you wants to go faster. What in the world? Day after day after day. And then there's the normal stuff of life. There's relationships between husbands and wives, brothers and sisters, parents and children, in-laws. You imagine traveling with your in-laws? Huh. All right? Just imagine that for a while. That'll cause you to moo lugubriously. There's responsibilities. There's cooking. There's cleaning up the tent. And there's sand everywhere. I don't know, every time I go camping, we always find the most sand, and it always finds its way into the tent. I don't know how that works. Okay. It might be one of the reasons my wife doesn't like camping. I just don't like sand. But all of these normal things, they were complaining. All they could see was the bad stuff that was happening in life. But as they complained, it says they did so in the hearing of the Lord. Literally, it says they did it in his ear. A very important truth is brought out at this point is that for God's people, all of life is lived in God's presence. We spent a lot of time looking at that. God has chosen to be with his people. But in being with his people, he hears everything they say. He sees everything they do. And so as they start to communicate their feelings about the situation, God is listening, God hears. Their words go straight to his ears. Now all of a sudden, when Jesus says those words, I tell you on the day of judgment, people will give account for every careless word they speak. That means something, doesn't it? That's why the psalmist says in 19:14, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in your sight, O Lord, my strength and my redeemer. God's anger is provoked and divine judgment is sent. God's covenant presence serves as both a blessing and a threat. Now, as they complain, it's not really a lot different than the book of Exodus, but Olson writes this. He says, the complaints that Israel makes to God in the book of Exodus are treated as legitimate needs. In the book of Numbers, however, these complaints are treated as acts of faithfulness. By the time we reach Numbers, the people of Israel know their responsibilities in the law and the commandments. And now Israel must take responsibility and is answerable for its relationship to God. What changed between Exodus and Numbers? Mount Sinai, where God sat them down at a mount for 9 months and said, listen, here's who you are. Here's who I am. Here's what life looks like. And he helps them to understand not all of life is sweetness and roses. Not all of life is cotton candy and roller coasters. There's some ugly things in life, but we're going to get through this together. And when we get there, it'll be glorious. So hang on for the ride. Here we go. And immediately they get disenchanted with the prospects of life as life is. This God's covenant presence serves as both a blessing and a threat. That's been indicated already because of the fiery pillar over the tabernacle. But this fire is a sign of divine activity, either for blessing or for judgment. As a blessing, it gives light, it gives warmth, it gives protection. It brings purification. As a judgment, it devours, it consumes, and as Nadab and Abihu found out, it kills. This blessing of God, of His presence, is a divine, active presence that blesses good and judges evil. In Exodus 24, verse 17, as they're at the mount, it reminds us that the appearance of the glory of the Lord was like a devouring fire on top of the mountain. Devouring, that which eats up. Deuteronomy chapter 4, verse 24, Moses is talking to another generation. And he says, understand this, young people. He says, understand that the Lord your God is a consuming fire. He's not one that you treat tritely. Yes, He's chosen you, but He's chosen you to be holy as He is holy. This is the God who's in your presence. Note the fire imagery in this passage, in just these three verses. Up in verse 1, His anger was kindled. It's like the what happens when you take the billows and you start to blow on those embers. They start to heat up and glow. His anger was kindled. It became hot. Then the fire of the Lord burned among them. The idea there is to blaze up. It ignited. It blew up. And it consumed some outlying parts of the camp. And we're not told if it was property or if it was people. But this fire of the Lord ate up perhaps possessions, perhaps some of the people themselves. And the name of this place is called Taberah because the fire of the Lord tabered among them, burned among them. Moses intercedes for them, and the divine judgment is removed. The people cry out to Moses. Why do they cry to Moses? Why don't they cry to God? Because God's sending the judgment. They can't go to God. They've already offended God. They need somebody to go to God who hasn't offended God. And Moses goes to God, stands in between as a mediator, and Moses prays to the Lord on their behalf. He prays to the Lord on behalf of the people, and the fire dies down. Or the King James says, the fire was quenched. It's put out. And the whole point is, the fire was put out in response to the prayer. But the whole point of this first paradigm is this. Don't become complainers. Complaining is going to slow you down in the wilderness. It's going to cost you more than you plan. There's going to be a place that is going to be marked in your life by Taberah, the burning of the Lord, as he works in His people to refine that dross from their midst. The second is this, craving earthly pleasures. So in verse 4, now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving. I want us to see the growing nature of this discontentment. It begins at the margins of the camp. We saw the margins already referenced. God burned at the outliers of the camp. And here we have the rabble. The Hebrew is asafsuf. It's kind of a reduplication. It's taken off the verb that means to gather, to gather. They're gathering together, and the fact that it kind of reduplicates the sound has a negative idea in the Hebrew. So this is a negative gathering of people. What are they gathering together to do? They're gathering together to moo lugubriously. They're gathering together to complain, to whine, to bellyache. Don't you always find that you feel better? What do they say? Misery loves company. Don't you always find that you feel better when somebody else sees life as bad as you do? Oh, I hate this teacher. You hate this teacher? I hate this teacher too. Yeah, she really stinks. Yeah, that's what I thought. In fact, she stinks so bad that, and then here we go, junior high. I hate this president. You hate this president? I hate this president too. Well, he stinks so bad that, politics in America. Junior high. It's the same thing over and over and over again. But it starts here with the rabble. And we're not told exactly, but the idea seems to be implied that this is the group back in Exodus chapter 12, verse 38, of the motley throng, the ones that weren't even part of Israel but came along for the ride. They get out of Egypt, they're going along, they're camping at Sinai along with the people. But this God wasn't their God necessarily. They're low on the totem pole of faith, if you will. And they're manifesting, in fact, that they don't really have any at all. This is a negative kind of gathering or assembly of ragtag collection of outcasts that congregates in order to voice their divisive gripes, Alter says. Dangerously, this spreads throughout the entire camp. Look at verse 4. Now the rabble that was among them had a strong craving, and the people of Israel wept again. What does he mean, wept again? The idea of the complaining that we just looked at. They wept again. How many people did it? It characterized the whole people of Israel. Look down in verse 9. Then Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans. This isn't just the outliers now of the camp. It's working its way inside the camp, and it's working its way throughout the entire camp. Ian DeGede writes this, "Grumbling is extremely contagious. It's an infectious disease that is easily passed from one person to the next. It typically originates among those with little or no spiritual insight, but it can easily be passed on from them to the whole community and draw in those who ought to know better." You ever get done talking to somebody, sitting in the quiet of your house and saying, "Why did I say that? I didn't need to say that. Why did I enter into that negative comment, that negative spirit? Why did I do that? I know better than that." Exactly. That's what complaining does. It draws others in. This is the growing nature of discontentment. If I don't get discontentment out of my life, discontentment will take control of my life. That's the point. If I don't get discontentment out when it's small, it's not going to stay small, my friend. Have you found that to be true? So what's the best thing to do? Whine about it? Praise, right? You find something opposite than whining. You praise God for what he's doing. You praise God for his blessings. You ask God to open your eyes so you can see his work in your life. Don't entertain grumbling, my friend, because grumbling will never, ever, ever stay small. Grumbling will always grow in your life, and as it grows in your life, it will begin to grow in other lives as well. That's why Hebrews chapter 12 says, "Let every man be careful, lest a root of bitterness springing up defiles a whole bunch of people." That's the idea here. But there's not just a growing nature to this discontent. There's a senseless nature to this discontentment. They're preoccupied with what? Look at the end of verse 4. "Oh, that we had..." "I wish I just had a steak." What? And that's not a bad thing. Okay. But really? I mean, you're going to stop the whole journey for this. "I wish I could go to McDonald's." It really sound like that's that big a deal? "Quiet, eat the package of peanuts we got in the back. We're keep on going." "No, I want to stop McDonald's now!" Really? Good grief. It's just McDonald's. But they're getting bent out of shape. Life is now defined by the fact that I can't have my meat now. Okay. It's just a little bit silly when you stop and put it in context, but it's really not anything that's new to the human race. Philippians chapter 3, Paul says, "Listen, I've often told you and tell you even now with tears that some walk, many walk, as enemies of the cross of Christ. Their end is destruction because their God is their belly. They glory in their shame and their minds are set on earthly things." That's so silly. That's so silly. When you stop and think about eternity, heaven, The future, he says, the glories that await us can't even compare with the bad stuff that you're going through. And it's bad. Stuff you're going through right now, it's bad. It's real. It's tough. It's long. It's monotonous. It's unfair. It's unjust. It sucks the wind out of your sails. But really, you're going to focus on this when after another 40 years, 60 years, 80 years, whatever God gives you, then for eternity, you've got Jesus and heaven and perfection and peace and joy and satisfaction. Really, you're gonna focus on this, and it's going to waylay you on your journey? There's a selective memory as they begin to recount the benefits of the past. In verse 5, they say, we remember the fish we used to eat in Egypt. You know those fish? They cost nothing. We remember the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, the garlic. They're speaking of a lush diet of well-watered region, garnished with spices and herbs. Remember where they're at. They're in the middle of the wilderness. Yeah, wouldn't that be nice? Fish. All we have is salt water on either side of us, when we have water. Oh, wouldn't it be nice to have a melon, a nice juicy melon? Wouldn't that be good? And then something to spice up life just a little bit. He says, and all these things were for free. Oh, that's a good one. Yeah, it was free. Who provided them the food that they got to enjoy back in Egypt? They're taskmasters, right? When did they get to eat it? When their work was done. Okay. So you're coming in, what, 11 o'clock at night? Okay, all the garlic and onions you can eat. Yeah, like that's not going to keep you up all night. All right. Oh, but it was free. Yeah, didn't cost you nothing, did it? 7 o'clock till 11 o'clock, doing nothing for that hard-earned free garlics and onion. Mm-hmm. Oh, I wish we could go back. Really? Yeah, really. I'll let you go back. No thanks. Alter says this term is a striking instance of selective memory. There's an underestimation of the provisions at present. There's nothing to look at but this stupid manna. It doesn't say stupid there, but that's the idea. Stupid manna. Okay. There's nothing. But he says, no, wait a minute. This stupid manna, verse 7, is like coriander seed. It's an aromatic herb. It's used to season. It's used. You said you wish you had seasoning, spice. This is like the spice of life. Its appearance is like bdellium, hard word to say, which is both beautiful and costly. It's like myrrh. Notably, this was in the Garden of Eden. This isn't just a nothing. God says this is beautiful. This is attractive. They could grind it, beat it, boil it, make cakes of it. There's a large variety in which they could utilize it and enjoy it. And verse 8 says, it's like the taste of cakes baked with oil. It's hard to exactly get the idea of this phrase. Like fresh oil, the cream of the oil, like olive oil. One translation says, it's like the finest pastries that are cooked in the finest of oils. This is some good stuff. Psalm chapter 78 says this was the food of angels, the bread of angels. Oh, and it was free. They talked about the free food they used to get. This is free. This is even less than the dollar menu on Wendy's. This is free stuff. Pull through the drive-thru, go out in the morning. It's there. You got it, much as you want. Do with it what you want. Enjoy it. But this isn't good enough for them out there in the desert because they're discontent. But not only is this discontentment growing, not only is it silly in perspective, but it's degrading in nature. Verse 4, and all the people of Israel wept. They were reduced to complainers. They looked like silly cows mooing lugubriously. I love that word, lugubriously. Really? This is what sin does to me. It makes me look like a stupid calf bellowing for its mother. Verse 10. Moses heard the people weeping throughout their clans everyone at the door of his tent. You know what? They didn't even care who saw them.
I wish that we could have the meat that we had back in Egypt.
What's wrong with you?
I just miss the meat that we had back in Egypt.
You know you look stupid.
I don't care. I just wish I had the meat. We had back in Egypt.
Really? Really? Throughout the episode, weep has the obvious sense of complain, but it's used instead of several other possible alternatives because it stresses the whining nature of the complaints. Now, when you get on a roll, you don't see yourself looking that way. Others do. It's a pretty good reason to get this out of your life. The dangerous nature of this discontentment is that in verse 10, the anger of the Lord blazed up again, but it didn't just blaze up. It blazed up hotly. It came in a great sequence. It was intensified because in verse 20, God says, "You have rejected the Lord because you wanted your meat." How did they reject the Lord? They reject the Lord by rejecting his redemption. Verse 20, why did we ever come out of Egypt? Why did we ever get out of that slavery? Why did we ever leave that place of bondage? Why? Why couldn't we be back? We didn't ever have all these stupid rules. We weren't in this stupid wilderness eating this stupid manna. I said, really? You're going to reject everything that I've done for you, everything that I've brought you through for food? They rejected his provision. Look at verse 18. Or look at verse, 18. 18. It says, and say to the people, consecrate yourselves for tomorrow, for you shall eat meat. For you have wept in the hearing of the Lord, saying, who will give us meat to eat? For it was what? It was better for us in Egypt. It was more good for us in that bad place than the place that you're going to bring us to, God. God, our taskmasters treated us better than you treat us. You would never say that to God. But you're saying that to God when you say, God, I don't like what you've given to me. They've rejected his promise. God had promised them good. They said, all we can see is the bad. Verses 18 through 20, the Lord says, I will give you meat. You shall eat. It'll be for a whole month, till it comes out your nostrils and becomes loathsome to you. We see how much they come. 8 55-gallon drums full of meat. 8 per person. That's a lot of meat. That's a lot of meat. And while it was still between their teeth, the Lord struck down the people, not the tents, not the cattle, the people, with a very great plague. The place is named Kibroth Hattaavah. It was a place of inordinate craving and became a scene of intense grieving. But what's so interesting about this whole scenario, as Wiersbe writes, when God really wants to judge people, he lets them have what they want. Think about that for a minute. Aren't you thankful sometimes that God tells you no? As a parent, do you ever tell your kid no? Why? Because you love your kids, right? Aren't you thankful that God sometimes tells you no because he loves you as his child? When God judges people, one of the most severe ways he can do it is to let us have what we want. Moses calls this place the graves of lust. And these graves become a monument to the danger of praying, not thy will, but mine be done. Don't we sometimes pray that? God, not your will, but mine be done. Be careful. Careful what you pray for. God just might give that to you. There's two more faith failures that hinder the progress of God's people. We'll just name them. We might come back to them next week. We might not. But in the middle of this passage, we see that Moses begins a rant. And he starts critiquing God's plan. fact, the next two scenarios, this contagion of discontentment reaches even the levels of leadership. Moses starts out by accusing God of doing things badly. In verse 10, it says, Moses was displeased. God was angry. Moses is displeased. The idea is that he judges this with his eyes. It was evil in his eyes. He doesn't just perceive it, but he judges this as bad. And apparently it's in line with God's own judgment. But Moses sees the current situation as bad, and he believes the current situation is done. This is it? Okay, God, let me tell you what I think of this. I think this stinks. I think you gypped me. And in five verses, we see that Moses uses the word me, my, I 20 times. I think you can count 14 in the English, but in the Hebrew, there's 20 different references to me, myself, I, my. In five verses. Who's Moses focusing on? It's not God. It's Moses. I mean, you just even read through it. It sounds like a child. He's critiquing God. Why have you dealt with me this way? Why have you done this evil to me? And the unspoken presupposition in this question is that this situation will find no resolution. God, really? You stuck me with this? This is where it is, huh? This is where it is. Moses, I wasn't quite done. Yes, this is where it is, but that's not it. That's not the end. You ever start to complain about something, and then you find out that they were just going to do something about it? And you're like, yeah, that's what you should have done. Thanks. Boy, do I feel stupid. Well, that's where Moses finds himself at this moment. Because God is just, injustice will never have the final word. The bad of the present simply becomes a platform from which to perceive God's eternal good. Moses, I'm going to do something with this. Would you wait? Would you watch? Would you settle down? Would you chill out just a second? Let me work. Nope, fix it now. Moses is consumed with himself. The me speech that he provides there. Consequently, Moses abdicates his role as mediator. Nowhere in this little rant does he say, God, this is where they're at. Please, would you hold back your anger? Would you please provide? He's not thinking about the people other than the stupid people. The people are complaining about the stupid everything else, and Moses is complaining about the stupid people. And as he's complaining about the people, he's not praying for them. There's going to be a lot at stake there. Instead, Moses questions and abdicates his responsibility. He says, God, are these people mine? Did I promise their fathers a certain land? Why'd you ever include me? How can I give them what they want? Just kill me now. And in between the lines, it says, I quit. You ever been there? Yeah, you have. More significantly, Moses implicates God as responsible for all of this. The end of this prayer, verse 15, kill me at once if I find favor in your sight, so that I may not see my wretchedness, my evil, the evil that you done to me. God, I'm sick of it. If this is how you're going to treat me, just kill me. Just get it over and done with. Then finally, God says, Moses, I've got a plan. He tells him his plan. And then Moses doubts God. God patiently hears out his servant. And Moses is still caught up in the moment and fails to see God's solution as a resolution. He said, really, God, have you done the math? 600,000 soldiers. I mean, I got like 600,000 Kyles and Calebs I've got to feed. Really? Where are you going to find herds to feed that? If you take all the fish in the sea, you're going to feed these guys? God, have you done the math? But when we're depressed, our understanding of the issues and our observance of the resources don't add up. God says, you know what, Moses? Is my hand too short? Stand back and watch whether or not my word will come true. The Lord responds to his lament with two sentences that expound every leader's theology of sufficiency, Brown writes. His dejected spirit is reminded first of the Lord's complete adequacy and then of his total reliability. It was a matchless message for a broken spirit. God said, what are you thinking? Moses said, what are you thinking, God? This is a lousy plan you put together. Moses himself is drawn into the complaining. In chapter 12, there's a condemning of God's people. We see it that there's a loneliness in the leadership. There's a sense of isolation, and God is going to deal with that. He's going to give him 70 elders to help bear the reins of ministry leadership. But we see that the first one to condemn God's people in ministry actually comes at the end of chapter 11, where Joshua says, hey, wait a minute. There's two guys out there doing God's work. Tell them to stop doing God's work. I mean, they're like even talking about God's word. Joshua, I don't share your concern. It's a good thing. It's good that no, I'm not going to tell them no. In fact, I wish more people would do it. And then in chapter 12, we have Aaron and Miriam. And really, Moses, you think you're all that? You think you're all that? Hasn't God like spoken through us too? And they start to talk to him. Well, actually, they don't really talk to him. They talk about him. They talk about him about a surface issue. Surface issue is in-law troubles. Oh, go figure. Verse 1 of chapter 12. Miriam and Aaron spoke against Moses because of the Cushite woman. Now, we don't know if this is Zipporah. We don't know if this is the Midianite wife. Midian and Cush are referenced together in Hebrews chapter 3:7. Perhaps it's the same place. Maybe his first wife died and this is a second wife. The other place that Cush usually represents is Ethiopia. Some have questioned whether this was a black woman because of being from Ethiopia, and then the coloring of Miriam's skin at the end, white. We don't know for sure. But apparently we do know that Miriam is responsible for initiating this conflict. She's responsible, there's several different clues. She's the oldest of the siblings. Her name is listed first. The verb here is feminine, and when two characters function with a single verb, the one that comes first is usually the principal agent in the action, the way the grammar works. And then we see that she alone is punished. It was interesting in this scenario that it's the sister who feels most threatened by Moses' wife. And that isn't always the case, but it's often the case. But that's just a surface issue. The root issue was this. They wanted control and leadership. Moses had just lamented that he needed help in leadership. In Micah chapter 6, verse 4, God says, I gave you a leadership package. It was Moses, it was Aaron, it was Miriam. The three of them together were your leaders. They understood that. But when God fixes Moses' need for help in leadership, he didn't give Miriam, the prophetess, more work to do. He didn't give Aaron, the high priest, more work to do. Instead, he brought others in rather than expanding their roles. And because they verbalized their disapproval of Moses, God is forced to point out the difference between his relationship with them and his relationship with Moses. Moses is more humble, verse 3. Probably Moses didn't put that in. Probably somebody after Moses' time wrote that in. It might have been Moses. But even if it was Moses, the fact stood true. Moses was more humble than anybody else on the entire earth. One of the ways we see that is Moses didn't even talk to them about it. Did Moses know about it? Maybe, maybe not. It seems that he would have. But Moses is more humble than others. Moses is more faithful than others, God says in verse 7. Verse 8, I grant Moses more access than others. Bottom line, Moses is my man to lead my people. And as God's anger is kindled and he goes up away from their presence, when God's anger has been kindled in the past, what's left in the wake is dead bodies. That's what we'd expect to see here in chapter 12, but it's not. It's a living death as Miriam is left with leprosy. Funny, do you see who asks Moses to pray for them? Look there. Who's the one that does the asking? Aaron. What's Aaron's position within the people of Israel? He's the high priest. He's the one man in the whole camp that could go into the Holy of Holies and talk with God himself. And here's the high priest who's inadequate and says, Moses, you got to go to God for me. I can't even do it. I've sinned. You know what? Looks a lot like Job, doesn't it? God says, Job, I'll heal them when you pray for them. Okay, I'll pray for them. And Moses does. In fact, he says, please, twice. God, please, please, please. In fact, there's only five words. Two of them are please. God, please, healer, please. Immediately. And God does, but then he sends her out outside the camp where she's shamed, and the whole camp knows it. Why? Because she's a leader. She should have known better. But here's the point, folks. Complaining in the wilderness looks like unbelief, and it's going to slow you down. Complaining always comes because I'm craving something other than what God's given to me. And when I start to crave something other than what God's given to me, I start to critique God's plan and say, really, God, are you sure you know what you're doing? And then I start to look around for ways that I can fix and change things. And I look at those who are in charge. I say, you know what, God, things would be a whole lot better if that person wasn't here, that person wasn't here, this person, if I could have. Yep. As we get started in 2018, put these things in the front of your Bible and pray to God that he spares us as a church from them. Pray to God that he spares you as an individual from these things. Because you know what? These sins are pervasive. They're spreading. And they will control. And they don't stop at the pew. All levels of leadership are dragged down by a focus on self and a whiny spirit. As we go through this desert, don't get lost by trying to do it alone. Let's walk with God by faith. And you know where we're going to hear it? We're going to hear it in our words. Because out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks.